Hello. In the previous audio snippet, we spoke a bit about how budgeting would happen in a new House of Commons under a new constitution in such a way that there'd be no power clots needed to make the process work. And we saw that recap some of the things that we mentioned before. We said that the budget would be passed through a series of separate bills, all of which would be topic specific. In other words, there'd be no monolithic big budget passed. It would be through a series of spending bills or bills that included spending in them. And these bills would go through the legislative process, just like any other bill. And just like any other bill, the new constitution would require that all these bills be around a specific topic. So you wouldn't have a bill that includes, say, a combination of a bridge to nowhere and spending on education, on things that are unrelated together in the same bill, because that creates room for corruption and a lot of other problems. Because if you oppose a bridge to nowhere, but the bill contains a clause that assigns $50 million to education or something like that, then your opponents who want the bridge to nowhere will attack you and say that you are against education because you opposed the bill and it was not that you didn't want education, it's just that you didn't want the bridge. But if you have the two things together that have nothing to do with each other, you're forced to play political games. And all of that would be eliminated if bills are associated to a specific topic. So there have to be two separate bills, one on the bridge to nowhere and one on spending on education, and each would be dealt with separately. And as we also said before, all bills, including any spending bill, would have to have a limit on their size. No bill could be, say, less or more than 10 pages long. And using regular font, no microfilm type font size, just to get around that rule. But so basically, we'd have these series of small atomic bills defining specific spending bill by bill, and any MC would be able to promote or propose bills and put them into the what we call the favoriting pool. And if they survive the favorite poll, then they can get into the voting queue and eventually be voted on. And there'd be no need for a committee system. No one specific MC as a committee chairperson saying yay or nay to the bill without the bill having had a chance to be seen by everybody else. So it'd be a more democratic system, and the budgeting would be done piece by piece, bill by bill. And it would be a little bit of a difficult process at the beginning, but as time went on, I know that the process would become much more much smoother and much more automated. And and to make things easier, there'd be a person that we've called the HR, the House Referee, who will be assigned the responsibility of enforcing all rules around bills. So like, for example, the constitutional rule that no bill can be more than, let's say, 10 pages long would be enforced by the HR. The HR would be looking out for bills that go past the 10 pages and call them out, and there'd be a procedure when a bill violates the rule, and the HR would be the one looking out for those things. Or the rule that no bill can be around a multitude of topics. So that requires human interpretation. So the HR would be responsible for looking through the bills that are being promoted or sponsored by the different MCs, members of Commons, and read through them and say, okay, this is about two different things. Why are these two things here? And So he would be refereeing the Bills, but it would always be through objective rules, applying objective rules, and there'd be consequences if he tries to use the rules to artificially stop or stop the Bills that he doesn't like, or promote the Bills that he likes unfairly. So this HR would also be responsible for coordinating all the bills that have to do with spending. So, for example, if there are two similar bills that are promoting duplicate spending, they are both about the same spending. Then the HR would be able to detect these duplicate spending bills and act accordingly to make sure that since the process to build the budget is decentralized, then there's possibilities of duplication or omissions and things like that, and the HR be in charge of the process to ensure that the budgeting does not have any gaps or duplications. And he would also be responsible for, as the bills get passed, voted and approved, to update a global budget. And you would see the budget kind of being formed before your eyes. And this budget would be available online. And all of us as citizens would be able to go online and watch the budget being formed. As the bills are being passed, you can see, okay, $10 million more dollars have been assigned to infrastructure and so forth. And this one single budget that is being kind of put together through this combination of separate spending, separate bills with spending in them. The bills can be about multiple things, including spending, but all around the same topic. But so the thing is, these bills would be coming together into this one budget, and the HR would be the person who would be coordinating to make sure that this one global budget visible to all of us would be up to date and reflect the spending that's being approved as the bills get voted in. And also we must emphasize the importance that any MC, any member of Commons under the new constitution will have the right to propose any bills. So he or she does not have to kiss up to anyone or have his brilliant idea thwarted by someone with envy who doesn't want that person to progress for one reason or another. If you have a brilliant idea and you have been voted into the House of Commons, this new American House of Commons, then you should have the opportunity to propose the idea to all your fellow colleagues in the House. And if your idea is a brilliant idea, hopefully they will listen to you and your idea will thrive. And if your idea is bad, then maybe, you know, people will not listen to you and you'll not get ahead. Obviously, this all also depends on what type of audience you have. You could have a brilliant idea, but if your audience is not that bright, they might not get the brilliant idea and it might not get through. So this doesn't guarantee that brilliant ideas will succeed, but at least it gives them a fighting chance. With the committee system, you're guaranteed that everything will be political. Everything will be power plays and who knows who and who kissed up to whom and who is listening to these special interest groups and who isn't, and all that political rubbish would be gone. And you'd have a more fair shot at having a brilliant idea go through, even if you're a quote nobody, a newbie in the House. So that's basically what we're trying to promote here, a more democratic legislative system. And we've been talking a little bit about the spending side of the budget, and in this audio snippet, we'd like to talk a little more about the other side, the taxation side. And before doing that, I guess we have to kind of look a little bit into what the current Constitution has to say about taxation. And it really doesn't, doesn't really say much about it, but we'll just go through some of the parts that mention taxation in a meaningful way. The first time taxation is kind of alluded to in this old constitution is in Article 1, Section 2 in the third paragraph. And I think the fancy way of saying third paragraph is the third clause. So Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3, it says here at the beginning, representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to the respective numbers. And then it kind of lays out how to calculate the population of each state and all that. But basically what it's saying is that any direct taxes that are gathered by the federal government must be redistributed to the states in proportion to their population. That's basically what this whole clause is saying in so many words. And so the question becomes, what is a direct tax? And that's when things get a little confusing, because in a more general sense, the difference between a direct tax and an indirect tax is that an indirect tax is a tax not on a person per se or his property, but on a transaction. So for example, a sales tax is an indirect tax because you're not taxing, the tax is not targeting a specific person. It is born out of a transaction. You're making a purchase, and because of this purchase or sales transaction that is happening, then a tax is triggered. So that's an indirect tax. And a direct tax is when you yourself, for example, are taxed. Like for example, in the case of an income tax, your income is being taxed, the income that belongs to you, or a property tax. You own a house, and that house is being taxed, and it's in your name. So that's the more general concept of what a direct tax is versus an indirect tax. But for some reason, which I'm not too clear on, when it comes to the Constitution, the definition of direct tax is a little more limited. And it's basically any tax on a property by reason of ownership. And it's been determined, I'm not sure by who or how or why, but basically the three types of direct tax that are recognized or understood to fit the definition of direct tax, at least from the constitutional perspective, are capitation. And that sounds like a gruesome term, but capitation actually means tax on a head, or tax per head, you know, like tax per person. Let's say like a flat tax of $400 per head per person. That's a capitation tax. And a second example of a direct tax is a tax on real property, and you know, like your house or some sort of thing you own, and something tangible you own. And the third type of direct tax, according to the definition that's understood for, regarding in the context of the Constitution, is a tax on personal property. So on real property or personal property. So those are the three and capitation. Those are the three types of direct and I'm sorry, just to qualify here, personal property can refer to something that is not tangible. You know, like if I'm not mistaken, it refers to dividends. For example, you own a share of a company, and you get dividends from that share. It's more of an intangible property, but you own it and you can get taxed on it. And that is an example of a direct tax according to the Constitution as well. So ironically, under this more limited concept of direct tax, an income tax is not a direct tax according to the Constitution, because it's more or less taxation on your income, and your income is maybe a sort of transaction. I'm not too clear why the income tax per se is not exactly a direct tax, but that's just the way it is. So the thing is that any type of direct tax According to the Constitution, when the federal government would receive it, it would be responsible for distributing it back to the states in proportion to their population. And the second time that the taxes are mentioned in the Constitution in a significant way is in Section 8. It just says the Congress, Section 8 of this first article, in the first clause, clause number one, the first paragraph, it says the Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. So it really does not say much other than the Congress has the power to tax people, and then the next time that it's really mentioned in a significant way is when you get to the 16th Amendment. And just to give you a quick story as to what happened that led to the 16th Amendment. Before we got to the 16th Amendment, which was passed around the end of the 19th century, I think I could be wrong, but the year I think was 1895. When this amendment was passed, it was before that happened. The United States federal government basically relied on excise taxes and tariffs. That's kind of how it financed itself. There was really no income tax before the 16th Amendment, and there was a brief period, I think of around 12 years, where there was an income tax, and it was at the start of the Civil War in 1861, when the Civil War started and the North needed money to finance the war, then they voted in an income tax, I think it was like a 3% a flat tax, and I think you had to make over $500 to pay the tax at $500 a year or something like that. But it was a kind of a small tax. It was increased later on, but then eventually, for a reason that I'm not too clear on, it was repealed in 1872. So it lasted for around 11 or 12 years. So after that, there was really no income tax at the federal level. But technically, income taxes were allowed by the Constitution, according to that article we read at the beginning, that clause, Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3. But then came a legal case, and I could have the name wrong. I don't quite remember the exact name, but I think it was the name of the case. The landmark case was Pollock versus Farmers Company or something like that. This lawsuit was around a company that was based in New York that was complaining that it was being taxed on its dividends. And they thought it was unconstitutional that the government was collecting taxes on their dividends and not distributing it amongst the states, because to them, that sort of taxation was a direct tax, because it was taxed on their property, the property of, their stocks, their dividends. So it made sense for them that money, if it was going to be collected, had to be distributed amongst the states. So they filed this lawsuit, and they won. As usually happened when the Constitution does something that doesn't sound right to people, then they quickly try to put in a 16th Amendment, a new amendment, and this is what came out, the 16th Amendment, which says, the Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived, without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. So it's basically saying, okay, we don't want to have this controversy where we collect some sort of tax on some sort of income or dividend and then have it, you know, taken away from us and given back to the state. So we want to be able to collect income taxes freely without any worry that there will be some Supreme Court decision voting us down. And I think this, so this overturned the previous decision. And I'm not sure, this is always very frustrating to me. And maybe I'm misunderstanding what happened, but it feels like an amendment is passed and it changes the law, and decisions that were made on existing law at the time are overturned. And I don't understand how things can be so retroactive. If you're operating under certain laws, then if you violate the laws, then yes, the system has the legal right, maybe not the moral right, but at least the legal right to punish you for violating the existing laws. But if you're playing with under the current rules and then the rules get changed later on, why are you then punished for rules that don't exist yet? So I've never understood how things can be retroactive like that. It seems inappropriate. But the thing is that this Pollack ruling was overturned, and I think they lost the case after having won it. And from then on, we've had income tax. Well, after the amendment was passed, legislators were afraid to try to pass an actual income tax because they thought, yeah, we have the amendment there, but we don't know if there's going to be some Supreme Court decision that overturns it or not. So they were kind of leery about passing an income tax. But eventually, I think it was around 1913 when Woodrow Wilson was in power in the White House. That's when they finally said, okay, we have to start collecting income tax. And we've had income tax in the U.S. as a general rule of law, at least at the federal level, ever since. And so that's kind of a brief story of taxation in the U.S. But as you can see in the Constitution, again, what is valid, what isn't valid, isn't too clear. Yeah, you could say, yeah, it's clear in the sense that, the federal government can collect tariffs, can collect excise taxes, and if it's a direct tax, it has to be distributed among the states. But other than that, the Constitution is very iffy and very silent about the whole concept of taxation. And I believe that is part of why we are in the financial mess we're in right now. And we, under a new constitution, we need to be more specific and clear about what taxation is and what is valid and what isn't valid. So before saying anything else, it's important to mention that we have to start from a basic principle. And I know this is going to rub some people the wrong way, but this is just the reality. Taxation is valid. And the federal government, the national government, let's not call it the federal government anymore. Under the new constitution, federalism will be gone. So it's going to be a national government. Yes, there are going to be state governments, but they're not going to have the sovereignty impunity that they have now. So under a national government, it is metaphysically valid, metaphysically correct or justifiable that a national government collect taxes. Obviously, the government needs taxation to finance itself. Otherwise, it's not going to magically exist. So taxations are metaphysically valid. So we can't get away from a government that collects taxes. And on top of that, taxation via the income tax system is not morally invalid, as many conservatives seem to kind of point out over and over again. They loathe the 16th Amendment, and they believe it was born out of the pits of hell, and they think it's the most awful thing in the world, which to me is kind of ironic because they don't seem to have any issues with the state government taxing them to death. But if it's the federal government, that it's the greatest evil in the history of mankind. And as I've shared in previous audio snippets, it doesn't make sense. If I'm being oppressed by the state government versus the federal government, does that change the oppression? If somebody gets shot in the head with a gun, does it matter if it's coming from a federal gun or a state gun? You're still getting shot in the head, and it's still the same consequence. So why does it matter at what level the oppression or whatever is coming from? So to me, those arguments about the federal government and income tax and how that is so evil is, to me, the most stupid sort of argument you can make. There is no distinction. It's just government. And government, whether it be national or state, does have the legal right or the moral, metaphysical right to collect income taxes. But now, so that's very important. But the Constitution has to start laying some ground rules about taxation. And one of the fundamental rules that it needs to lay down is that taxes should not be used as a weapon to influence behavior. And especially behavior at the economic level. And what we mean by this is, yes, taxes will influence behavior. There's a level of influence that cannot be denied or removed, or it's like that's just part of it, in the sense that if I'm taxed, I have less income, obviously. And if I have less income, then I can spend less money. So if someone, let's say, wanted to save some money and take a trip to Bermuda, and they get hit with a big tax, and you know that extra money that they thought they would have for that trip is gone, then they will not take the trip. And that means their behavior changed. They decided not to spend on something, not to do something, because they had less money available. So obviously taxation will influence behavior in that way, in the sense that it limits your income. But the problem is when taxation is used as a weapon to control people's behavior. Like for example, taxation on cigarettes. So the government has decided we don't want people to smoke anymore. And not that I'm for smoking, I'm just talking about just as a general principle that, let's say the government says, we don't want people to smoke anymore, so we're going to impose a heavy cigarette tax on people so that it will become so expensive for them that they won't be able to smoke anymore. So taxation then has become a weapon to try to control people's behavior. And that is metaphysically wrong. And regardless of whether smoking is good or bad, I hate smoking personally, but if you're going to attack smoking, it cannot be done through taxation. That is the wrong approach. And taxation should also have as few incidental consequences on economic behavior as possible, because some are intentional and some are not. So by this principle, excise taxes would be unconstitutional under this new constitution. Why? Because excise taxes are taxes on the consumption of a specific good. And as we said, that's an example of an indirect tax. You're taxing a transaction or a good. But that type of indirect tax would be unconstitutional, because you are applying a tax on something to control how much of it is demanded by the population. And the problem with that is that when you allow the government to create those sorts of taxes, then you open the door for corruption, because then interest groups are going to come in, like the tobacco lobby, for example, coming in and say, hey, you know, if you help us lower that tax that you've been imposing on us, we're going to support your campaign and this and that and the other. And then another interest group, you know, comes and says, hey, you know, we don't want you to tax our products, so we want to give you a financial donation here. Please help us to prevent that tax being passed. So it opens the door for a lot of corruption, and it also creates intrusion by the government trying to control people's behavior in an inappropriate way and in an indirect and dishonest way. It has to be, if the government feels that tobacco is evil, then it should attack it in a different way, not through taxation. So that's one of the reasons why that should be one of the fundamental principles of taxation in the new constitution. Taxes cannot be used as a weapon to influence behavior. Now, there are examples where behavior is inadvertently influenced, maybe not, you know, not by political motivation, but just as an incidental consequence. An example of that is the sales tax. Under the new constitution, sales taxes would be illegal. And the reason for sales taxes being illegal is that under this concept, they wouldn't be valid because whenever you do a have a sales tax, let's say, a process of production. It starts in a factory, and the factory has to get materials from its suppliers, and it puts together the product, and maybe it has to offsource it to another company to do another stage of the processing of the product until eventually the product is produced and sold to the person at the supermarket. So the problem is that at every stage of the process, a sales tax is being applied. So if the process the product requires three stages to get to you, and you then, you know, pay your sales tax at the supermarket, then a sales tax is going to be applied each time. And so that what that causes is that it creates a lack of incentive at specialization. So then you're forced to kind of do everything in-house on your own, because every time that you offsource it to another company that has a speciality that can do that more efficiently, you get penalized. So you try to do it all yourself, and you reduce the number of stages. So sales tax has this kind of peculiar effect of reducing efficiency, because it punishes you if the product has a transition in between, and that's why sales taxes should be illegal. This is different from a value added tax. That's a different concept. A value added tax doesn't have the effect that I just mentioned about regarding sales taxes. So value added taxes would not be unconstitutional, but sales taxes would be, and that'd be a big blow to a lot of states currently that rely on sales taxes, but they can switch to an income tax, and they would be fine. Now, the thing would be that in my personal opinion, and I'm a little ambiguous on this, but I believe that based on this principle, we know sales taxes and excise taxes would be illegal. Income taxes would be valid. And another tax that would be technically valid are value added taxes, but you have to be very leery about them as well, in the sense that they create a lot of bureaucracy. And I think this snippet is not going to be, there's not enough time on this snippet to kind of describe how value-added tax works. It's used a lot in Europe and in many countries around the world, and it has a lot of good points to it. But the problem, without going into all the details that value-added taxes do is that even though they bypass that problem of the staging that we were mentioning with the sales tax, it doesn't punish the increase of stages for efficiency, where you distribute the process amongst all these stages or participants, because it just the value-added tax basically just taxes the portion of value that you added to the product. So if you add the value in three different stages, but they add up to the same total added value, the same tax will be paid at the end of the day. So the process is not punished. But the problem with the value-added tax system is that it creates a lot of bureaucracy, that you have to keep a lot of control over, you know, all your invoices and keep track of how much value-added tax you've paid. Because in the value-added tax world, you pay a tax, your portion of the tax to the government, and you get paid back. You pay the part of the value that you added, and you get paid back the tax that you pay to others. It's kind of a messy thing, but at the end of the day, you have to do a lot of bookkeeping to have a value-added tax be efficient. So it creates a lot of bureaucracy. But I think that technically, and this is where I'm a little bit ambiguous, but I think that it should be allowed as a viable form of taxation. But I guess it should be used infrequently. So now, okay, we have a income tax, and another tax that should be valid is the tariff, and the a tariff on imported goods. And this brings back brings us to an issue that I believe we'll discuss in the next snippet, because this one has gone a little long. So we'll discuss tariffs. We'll discuss the concept of why they're valid, even though they are a little bit anti-capitalistic, you could say, or anti-free market. But there's a justification for leaving them as a viable option in the new constitution. And we'll also talk about, if we're going to allow an income tax, what sorts of restrictions are there going to be on it to make it successful? So we'll talk about that hopefully in the next snippet. Thank you very much.